The National Archives podcast series, Selling the Age of the Train, British Railway Passenger Marketing and Travel in Britain in the 1960s to 70s, presented by Dr. Hiroki Shin as part of the Railways Change Lives conference.
As one of the longest standing forms of mechanical transportation, railways have produced abundant visual materials in its long existence. As we have seen in previous presentations in this conference, there are maps, photographs, drawings, cartoons, and even scribbles by railway clerks. Another set of visual materials the railway companies produced are advertising and publicity materials. Especially pictorial posters and guidebooks are popular, and the image of past railways is partly shaped by these images depicted in railways' external communications. When we conducted the research project, The Commercial Cultures of Britain's Railways, 1872 to 1977, one of our chief aims was to understand the context and the inner workings of railway marketing and to link the images created by the railways to contemporary culture and society, as well as to the overall business of the railway industry. From a fairly early stage of a project, we encountered some difficulties. At first, we, including two PhD students who carried out related sub-projects on the railway's visual publicity and marketing in the interwar period, expected to find a substantial amount of records on the activity of the advertising or publicity departments of the railway companies. Among the massive collections of surviving records meticulously collected and kept by the railway companies and then by institutions like the National Archives and the National Railway Museum, something like the GWR Publicity Department reports. During our project, however, we didn't come across such a treasure trove, though the situation is a bit better with the BR period. Curiously, the sections that so eloquently propagated railway information and distributed railway images have left a relatively small amount of information about themselves. Also, marketing itself is a relatively new concept. Its modern forms and ideas were largely developed after World War II. We believe that the railways were at the forefront of marketing, especially in service and transport marketing for most of our target period. This situation didn't make our inquiry easy, but worthwhile, as we traced how railway marketers created, adopted, and improved their strategies and techniques as they were creating the very concept of transport marketing as they went along with their everyday business. Although our knowledge of the history of railway marketing is still frustratingly patchy, we now know much more than we did before we started the projects. In my presentation today, I'm going to talk mostly about the post-war period of nationalized railways. This period, for some people, is not exactly the most exciting period of railway marketing, and it certainly requires some courage to talk about this period to the audience who know the time much more than I do. Anyway, the nationalization period is an important period for several reasons. First, when we think about today's privatized railways, the understanding of its direct predecessor is probably indispensable. Secondly, even though the late 20th century was mostly characterized by the massive growth of car travel and the taking off of popular air travel, the railways remained a gigantic operation affecting the lives of numerous people on and off the rail. In the late 20th century, travel and transport had come to be closely linked with how people lived and how they saw their world. Last but not least, the NIM acquired a substantial collection of railway ephemera, the Forsyth collection some years ago, which is particularly strong in the post-war period. The collection not only provides us by itself insight into Britain's post-war railway and its relationship with passengers, but when combined with the records held at TNA, it sheds light on the wider history of Britain's railways and British society in the 20th century. As there's not enough time for us to go into the long history of railway marketing from its beginning, I start with the interwar period, which some historians regard as the golden age of railway advertising. Despite the popularity of interwar railways among historians of various sorts, the railway business in interwar Britain didn't enjoy commercial success. The railway companies had already begun to face problems in the late 19th century when their profitability started to fall. and the business situation significantly worsened from the 1920s on. This was caused primarily by road competition. Soon after World War I, the number of commercially owned lorries and coaches, as well as privately owned cars, rapidly increased. From the turn of the 20th century, there had been competition from electric trams, but it was confined to urban areas. Whereas road competition during the interwar period represented an assault on almost all areas of railway business. A Stone and Law's estimate on consumer spending during the interwar period vividly illustrates the point. As early as 1925, consumer spending on private transport, mostly car use, began to outpace spending on rail travel, and the gap between them soon widened. Then, around 1930, buses and coaches overtook rail travel. There was an across-the-board dip in transport spending during the economic depression, but the relative decline of rail travel is apparent in the significant growth in the importance of private transport. In the face of such strong competition, the railway business was left with few options. Because of their large infrastructure, railways couldn't possibly keep pace with the commercial and technological innovation in road transport. As far as passenger travel was concerned, however, railway companies did make some efforts, and their chief means of competition with road travel was marketing. The railway industry, in fact, had been conducting certain forms of marketing since the 19th century. It had done so because the highly dense rail network in Britain necessitated competition among rival railway lines. The railway's high-volume, low-margin business model, famously initiated by the Midland Railway with its wide-scale provision of third-class travel, was accompanied by various advertising and publicity efforts, including posters, pamphlets, maps, and timetables. The early railway advertising of letterpress, newspaper advertisement, and handbills were gradually taken over by more colorful and imaginative tourist programs, landscape photographs, pictorial posters, and official guidebooks. As with the pre-World War I railways, interwar railway marketing undertook numerous publicity projects, which were much more sophisticated than those of the previous periods. The most famous are pictorial posters enticing potential customers by showing beautiful scenery, female bathers, and powerful trains. Our projects have identified, for example, a distinctive shift in photographic image in the 1930s from landscape to tourist activities, possibly indicating the railway's efforts to align rail travel with the aspiration of modern consumer life. Moreover, because the readership of daily newspapers was growing massively, press advertising received renewed attention. The intensification of marketing also meant a strong emphasis on the holiday market, especially for the middle and lower middle classes, who had relatively larger disposable incomes and longer holidays than their counterparts in previous generations. From the surviving records, we have a rough idea of how the railways tried to balance its publicity effort. In fact, despite the impressions we get from the visual impact of pictorial posters, the railway company's spending on posters was relatively modest compared with other advertising expenditure. The largest expenditure was consistently press advertising. There is also evidence to suggest that the guidebook was regarded by companies like the Great Western as the backbone of their travel promotion. In any case, the interwar railway companies were invariably of the opinion that publicity was a crucial weapon to fight competition. But at the same time, the companies were operating under strict financial constraints. The correspondence between the LNER and the so-called Big Five artists on the production of pictorial posters held at the NRM not only shows how such collaborative business was conducted, but also how difficult it was to sustain the relationship with limited financial resources. In fact, advertising was one of the first areas of the railway industry where budgetary control was introduced. From the perspective of marketing history, the railway's image strategy is only part of the story. A similarly important development in the interwar period is the growth of the railway's marketing organization. Pre-World War I marketing focused mostly on advertising and publicity, but during the interwar years, the advertising departments of the Big Four grew into what can be described as marketing departments by assuming roles in public and customer relations, direct sales, and market research. The SR created the position of public relations officer in the mid-1920s, says to be the earliest such position in Britain's commercial organisations. Not surprisingly, the first recorded use of the term public relations in Britain in the Oxford Dictionary of English is in the railway context. The SR's PR officer John Elliott is a famous case. He had worked for the New York Times in the United States and the Daily Express and the Evening Standard in Britain before commencing work for the SR. Later, he became one of the most celebrated railway managers of 20th century Britain. Flipping through company magazines and other records, one can identify some of the railway marketers. The early generation of interval railway marketers like the GWR's William Henry Fraser has long careers in the railway industry. The LNER's W.M. Teasdale worked as an advertising officer of the pre-war Northeastern Railway. The LMS's head of advertising, T.C. Jeffries, started his railway advertising career from as early as 1903 with the Midland until he retired in 1927. This demonstrates the continuity of railway marketing that extends beyond the interval period, suggesting the historically close link between railways and marketing. The historical link doesn't mean that the railway companies were traditionalists in their marketing ideas. On the contrary, interval railway marketing was a story of a series of reorganization, experimentation, and adoption of new techniques and ideas. For instance, the LMS established a commercial department around 1930, which conducted a form of demand forecasting at a time when market research was yet to take off in Britain. More interestingly, the Big Four invested heavily in the technique of direct sales. In the mid-1920s, when the threat from road competition became clear, railway companies began to inculcate what they called railway salesmanship among their employees. Gradually, the use of railway salesmanship became institutionalized, with companies providing evening classes, examinations, and a more general workforce education through internal publication and company magazines. This culminated in the late 1930s, when the LMS produced a textbook on salesmanship, which was to be used in the company's School of Transport. This book begins with the question, what is a salesman? And it goes on to teach sales techniques, and it also equipped readers with geography, history, and industry in order to understand what sorts of commodity they were selling and to cater to the individual needs of customers. Armed with similar knowledge, some of the GWR's employees took salesmanship examinations, responding to questions like how to sell railway travel to those who are almost determined to take coach on the excursion trip. Around the same time, the SR inaugurated an annual sales competition called Southern Sales League, in which railway stations competed with each other on the sales they made in the district. The evidence from these sales activities suggests that, far from being this conservative provider of traditional transportation described by some business historians, the interval railways were undertakings whose sales played a crucial part. The overall commercial result was, as we saw in Stone and Law's estimates, not a brilliant success. In business terms, it might be the case that the railway's commercial effort only managed to alleviate its decline. In cultural and social terms, however, interval railways marketing left in its wake the memory of a golden age of railway, with colourful images, rich literature, and glamorous locomotives. In any case, historians and railway companies alike sometimes forget that the railways are retailers as well as suppliers of transport. Their selling side is inseparable from the engineering and operating sides of the business. Therefore, our aim of getting deeper knowledge of railway marketing is not to reduce the railway's cultural production to business strategy, but rather to show the commercial cultures of the railways existed in the junction of business, culture, and social practice. And the following discussion is an attempt to extend this perspective to post-war Britain. World War II left the railways in no better position. As we know, the railway share in the travel market declined further. The number of private cars continued to increase, and slightly later, domestic air travel started to take off, threatening the railway's stronghold on domestic long-distance travel. Under such circumstances, it came as no surprise that the railway's financial position deteriorated. The nationalisation in 1948 failed to cure their troubled situation. By 1955, railway's total deficit had reached £40 million. The modernisation plan of 1955 was expected to extract the railways from this financial quagmire by upgrading the entire railway system and organisations. The plan included an organisational restructuring, wide-scale adoption of diesel and electric traction, and a rehabilitation of the corporate image. British Railways' marketing organisation was one of the areas where updating was urgently needed. Since its marketing, conducted by six marketing regions, was merely an extension of the pre-war arrangement, but with a much lower budget and possibly less enthusiasm. Like other areas of improvement, the reform of marketing in British Railways progressed slowly. One factor, though, would have a significant impact on the BR's future course, the establishment of the design panel. The design panel was created to review BR's design practice from trains to uniforms, and its objective was to establish the means of ensuring that the design and the decoration of the British Transport Commission's property and equipment are aesthetically satisfying to contemporary taste and enhance the Commission's prestige and commercial aims, insofar as this is consistent with functional requirements. The panel members enlisted from different sections of the company included the chief commercial manager, the chief publicity officer, and some outside experts like the director of the Council of Industrial Design. Crucially, the panel was also joined by the members of the design research unit, most notably Milner Gray and Misha Black, who spearheaded post-war Britain's industrial design. The most celebrated projects of the design research unit were the Britain Can Make It exhibition in 1946 and the Festival of Britain in 1951. The creation of the design panel was a dramatic step in two senses. First, it was an attempt to reconceive British Railways' design activity from a national perspective, at a time when the railways still maintained their pre-war regional identity and mores. Second, it was an attempt to redesign British Railways by a cross-sectional group of people, in which the influence of marketing specialists was evident. The minutes of the design panel meeting held at TNA is a fascinating read, as it covers most of BR's design work, from locomotive and carriages to stations, livery, hotel, catering, and later the entire corporate image. As part of its activity, the design panel held a conference in 1960, which was attended by a cross-section of BR members and outside experts. In the opening address, John Ratter of the Council of Industrial Design reiterated the idea of a holistic approach to design. Comparing the current situation of BR design with railway design in the past, Ratter said that combining functional qualities with aesthetic distinctiveness had become difficult because of the complexity of modern engineering, and that the only solution to the problem lay in a cooperation between engineers, industrial designers, and architects. Similarly, George Williams, the director of BR Industrial Design, emphasized the crucial importance of orchestration in design, to quote, so as to create harmony instead of the discourse often represented by many familiar examples about us today, unquote. This orchestration was fundamentally important to the railways because design expressed the personality of the industry. And if design was to express the personality of BR, a new design would reconfigure the relation between BR and its customers. A glimpse of the role of design in the railway's changing relationship with customers can be seen in BR's willingness to listen to the opinion of the public regarding its design work. The evaluation of a set of experimental carriages called XP64 sought opinions from both experts and the public through questionnaires, public correspondence, and interviews. Also, it is worth noting that during the XP64 survey, the Central Council for the Disabled and the Red Cross Society were also invited to comment on the accessibility of the new carriage. Public opinions were not just collected, they were analysed, discussed, and sometimes incorporated into subsequent design. It is not clear when customer feedback on carriage design started to be taken seriously in the railway industry, But BR undoubtedly made some effort, unlike some early railways, whose carriage design and interior were mostly determined by mechanical engineers, sometimes with the help of their wives. Despite its active work, it took some time for the reconfiguration of BR design to see results. And the impetus for change came from a section of BR that embraced the determinedly economic idea about rail transport. This economic approach was represented by the report Reshaping of British Railways, published by BR under Dr. Beijing's leadership in 1963. The report has been criticized for its hard-nosed view of unprofitable lines. It certainly left a deep scar on Britain's railway history. But for better or worse, there were some developments during this period, and to ignore them would be to neglect the experience of Britain's travelling public. One of the developments, which was seen by quite a few contemporary people as a positive development for the railways, came from the idea of targeting particular types of traffic, known as the selective sales approach. One of the key targets was mid-distance or semi-long-distance travel. This type of traffic was described as intercity. The rationale of such long-distance networks fairly obvious to BR officials, since it represented an area of traffic where competition from air travel, which held an advantage in longer distances, and from the private car, whose strengths lay in shorter distances, was much less intense. It was believed, therefore, that BR could at least maintain its level of traffic, and with careful planning, might even be able to boost its business volume. Nevertheless, the report cautioned that BR should not feel complacent about intercity services and that improvements were necessary. After 1963, intercity service was firmly established as one of the chief focuses of BR's passenger service. Stanley Raymond, while on replacing Dr. Beijing as the chairman of the British Railways Board, stated that providing really fast, clean, silent intercity services was one of his three main tasks. In the early to mid-1960s, BR was going through its belated organizational restructuring, and marketing was no exception. BR transferred the function of advertising from its public relations sections to its commercial section in order to better serve the company's marketing policies. The commercial section itself underwent a reorganization, and as a result of which it was given greater authority over traffic planning. These company-wide preparations paved the way for the introduction of the new intercity service, which began on 18th April 1966 with electrified passenger train services between London, Liverpool and Manchester. The intercity was to become BR's flagship passenger service in the following three decades. The name intercity was not invented in 1963. It was first used in September 1950 by BR's Western Region for its 900th service from Paddington to Wolverhampton. Although at the time the name was derided as bereft of inspiration, it was subsequently became a household name in Britain and in other parts of the world. Gary Smith argues that the recognition that long-distance trains were different from other trains was a significant conceptual change that laid the foundation of the intercity network. Another important recognition was that the future of BR lay in the fast and semi-fast trains, even if that meant sacrificing local stopping services, another contentious idea, an idea hotly debated on even today's railways. From the marketing point of view, one of the achievements of the intercity service, if I may call it an achievement, was that it equipped BR with a strong national brand. In the previous period, BR's product range was fragmented, with each region offering its own products and brand. At the same time, the existence of various discount tickets, with a number of restrictions attached, confused the customers to no small extent. L.H. Williams, the chairman of the British Railways Board Commercial Committee, clearly recognized this nagging problem in 1965, and intercity was a perfect example of BR's effort to create a strong national product by offering the main interurban trains under a single brand. Having a single brand also made it possible for BR to rationalize its marketing by avoiding duplication of publicity and other promotional activities. Most marketing scholars today would agree that having a strong brand is usually a good thing for a corporation, especially for larger undertakings, if this always applies to the railways is a moot point. The emergence of a national railway brand also had a cultural implication. As it happened, the intercity brand enabled the British public to imagine a coherent railway network, possibly for the first time in Britain's railway history. The creation of a coherent image for the railways was firmly supported by BR's wider branding scheme. In 1965, a year before the intercity's introduction, BR embarked upon an ambitious endeavour called the Corporate Identity Programme. This was to drastically change the entire corporate image of BR by implementing a nation and corporate-wide design scheme. The Corporate Identity Programme had originated from the work of the design panel. The precursor of the Corporate Identity Programme was the designing of new carriages and BR uniforms, which was made public in early 1963. An interesting feature of the 1963 design project was that it was introduced in an exhibition called New Design for British Railways, held at Design Centre, London. Here one can sense the unmistakable influence of the Design Research Unit, whose possible work of promoting industrial design had been achieved chiefly through high-profile exhibitions. The file of the exhibition's preparatory work held at TNA shows that BR was taking the exhibition quite seriously. The exhibition was not just an event to show BR design, but also an opportunity to gain public acceptance, and as we saw in the XP64 survey, to get public feedback on the design work. Hence, it was a crucial part of BR's design activity. The Corporate Identity Programme in 1965 was also introduced with an exhibition held at the Design Centre called The New Face of British Railways. In the opening speech on 5th January 1965, Beeching extolled the virtues of the Corporate Identity Programme, which was intended to make the visual image of British Railways, to quote, brighter and more distinctive, to emphasise rather than conceal growing unity of the organisation as a whole, and to reflect the very great changes that are taking place in our equipment and services, unquote. As if to exemplify the inseparability of design and organizational change, he didn't forget to make the economic case for the Corporate Identity Programme, saying, good design is cheap. In application, it needn't cost no more than poor design, and often costs far less. The most conspicuous feature of the Corporate Identity Programme was the new double arrow symbol, designed by Gerald Barney of the Design Research Unit, which was based upon the idea of two-way traffic movement. The new symbol could also be interpreted as a combination of rail tracks and arrows to produce an electrification flash. This symbol replaced the so-called BR sausage or double sausage, as well as the BR emblem of, in the words of George Williams, tortured lions jumping over railway wheels. Another feature was the replacement of regional colours with standard house colours. New uniforms and a rail alphabet were also introduced. All the new features were criticised to varying extents. The new uniform was frowned upon as too German. The analysis of a questionnaire collected at the Design Centre noted that of 126 comments on the uniform, only 38 approved of the uniform design, and the forthright disapproval was often based on an ethnocentric basis. The new symbol was sardonically described as barbed wire, but most contentious change was the shortening of British Railways to British Rail. British Rail was officially advocated as a kind of strong, hard-hitting phrase BR needed to sell its service, but Design Magazine noted that the new name appeared to be the least satisfactory aspect of the new programme, saying that it offered no great advantage and had an odd connotation, particularly when spoken. Some railway men hated the shortened name so much that the reader of Rail News wrote to the paper, "Shoot the man who thought at British Rail." Milner Gray, who is said to have come up with the new name, may have been surprised to encounter such an emotional reaction. It is clear that Corporate Identity Programme introduced a tension within the corporation. The resistance to the new design scheme had been foreseen by BR officials, and it was partly for this reason that the company prepared its Corporate Identity Manual. The manual was modelled after the similar design manual produced by the British European Airways in 1958, when the airline company carried out a corporate identity program similar to BER's, only on a relatively smaller scale. British Rail's corporate identity manual included an introduction by Stanley Raymond, which was in fact drafted by George Williams. To quote, "The future of British railways depends upon what the travelling public and industry think of them. And to create the right public impression, we have to provide good service and also present an appearance of smartness and efficiency. The best way of creating the right visual impression of an organisation as widespread as ours is the consistent use of the same well-designed distinguishing features. This gives cumulative impact of the features used, causes the organization's facilities to be easily recognized, and produces a corporate identity which reflects the unity of the organization behind all activities." This statement confirms that the corporate identity program was intended to address both the internal unity of the corporation and BR's external image. It also suggests that BR officials hoped the company's new image would appeal to the traveling public by presenting a more distinctive and coherent image, an image more easily recognisable and memorable in the public mind than that of British Railways. Furthermore, the reconfiguration of BR's image shows the dynamic and far-reaching relationship between the transport provider and the public. A point in case is the design of railway stations, where following the corporate identity programme, the new corporate design scheme began to be implemented. The first station to be transformed was North Wembley in 1965. In the following years, approximately 2,000 stations got a new look, along with 4,000 locomotives and 23,000 passenger carriages. The corporate identity program, therefore, had a significant impact on the scenery of Britain, where passengers and non-passengers saw, felt, and used railway-related facilities on a daily basis. The social impact of especially the station design was both positive and negative, especially when we remember that only 4 years before the corporate identity program, the contentious issue of demolishing the Euston Arch stirred public outrage. As the case of station design suggests, it is difficult to measure the extent to which the program directly impacted the feelings of British people. But a fairly large number of people showed their interest in BR's new design. The new face of British Railways exhibition was visited by a total of 66,777 people, a record number of visitors for the design centre. The two new features of the BR's passenger service, the corporate identity and intercity service, represented the focus of the company's aggressive marketing in the following period. British Rail made extensive use of TV commercials as well as more traditional advertising media such as posters and booklets. In 1967, the company spent £1.3 million on advertising. Along with the flourishing of new advertising media, traditional advertising methods also underwent a change. This was especially evident in BR's attitudes towards pictorial posters. Since the 19th century, railway companies had produced a considerable number of pictorial posters featuring tourist destinations. From the 1910s, the railway companies often collaborated with local tourist offices, sharing the cost of promotion with local authorities on a 50-50 basis. In the post-war period, British Railways had a similar arrangement in which the company contributed one-third of the publicity cost for tourist destinations. By 1960, there were 147 joint schemes in operation. However, around the time of the corporate identity program, most of the joint schemes were abandoned, and the number of pictorial posters depicting tourist destinations fell in number. Instead, BR posters began to emphasize the national network or rail travel in general, and some BR publicity came to resemble what could be called lifestyle advertising. The memorable advertisement featuring the young lady Monica and the catchphrase "See a friend this weekend" had little to do with scenery and with BR's technological side. Slightly later, BR introduced the free onboard magazine Travelling for first class passengers under the new attempt. Not surprisingly, an article on BR design appeared in the spring 1973 edition of the same magazine. This was perfectly in line with the company's strategy of embedding railways in British life through design. Advertising and publicity were accompanied by material improvements in service. In 1969, the Intercity brand was strengthened and extended by equipping all trains with air conditioning and by branding all sleeper services in Britain as Intercity Sleeper. The sleeper service, whose introduction was originally proposed by BR's marketing section, was particularly successful in combating the competition from domestic airlines that had been eroding some long-distance routes. Overall, British Rail's intercity service gave a long-awaited boost to rail passenger business. Its impact has been described as the Sparks effect, as the service exerted an instant effect on the volume of passenger travel. In the first 3 months of its service, Manchester-Liverpool-London traffic increased by 66% from the previous year, and the level of traffic was sustained well into the 1970s. The recovery of rail passenger business was by no means the result of BR's hard sell alone. It was rather the result of BR's taking passengers more strategically into consideration. Many new services, including air conditioning, were introduced because they were thought to attract passengers. In other words, the upgrading of passenger service was achieved by providing what, at least in BR's view, customers wanted. The railway business had been obsessed with data gathering since the mid-19th century, when railway companies were obliged to submit official returns, including a wide variety of statistical information. Up to the early 20th century, however, little use was made of such statistical data for marketing purposes. And the passenger data was treated mostly as a record of business performance rather than as a basis for service improvement or forward projection. This gradually started to change. As early as 1913, the North Eastern Railway distributed an internal publication called Population Tables and Passenger Booking among its staff, possibly to help with traffic planning. This publication contained a comparison between the population around every station in the territory and the corresponding passenger booking numbers. And it was later updated by the LNER. In the GWR, a sort of market research in the vein of the BBC's listener survey was discussed, although it was not implemented. The LMS was probably ahead of the times when it conducted an onboard passenger survey around 1936. Thus, even the pre-war railway companies tried to identify their customers' behaviors and preferences. Preoccupation with data gathering remained strong in the nationalized railways. Passenger censuses were meticulously collected from the beginning of British railways, and BR realized the need to apply modern market research techniques to the data they had at hand around the late 1950s. That was when the company started to analyze the flow of passengers on some selected routes, as opposed to the previous statistics on ticket purchases that showed only the origin and destination of travel. In 1957, BR was already conducting passenger questionnaires on board the train. For the customer surveys conducted on the East Coast and the West Coast main lines in 1957, about 18,000 questionnaires were returned. BR's market research intensified in the 1960s and especially after 1963. The reason was obvious. In 1963, BR's chief commercial officer noted the urgent need to obtain market knowledge in order to compete effectively with road transport. Even though BR had yet to dedicate a single department to such purposes, when the British Institute of Management conducted a survey on the use of market research in British industry in 1961, BR responded that its market research originated in 1933, possibly referring to LMS's commercial research section. BR used both in-house and external agencies for market research. For example, in 1963, a survey report was submitted to the British Railways Board by Research Projects Limited, a company that conducted a series of surveys for BR from 1962 to the mid-1970s. The company carried out a detailed survey featuring interviews with business executives, salesmen, housewives, and other types of passengers. The report provides a good historical record of passengers' voice. The slide shows a lively discussion of members of a women's organization in Norwich. The ladies talk about the cost of rail travel, their shopping practices, how they were inconvenienced by the discontinuation of the so-called theatre train service in the evening, and how awful they thought onboard meals were. Most of what they discussed sounded quite similar to what today's passengers talk about, but compared to the railway's side of history, the history of passengers is difficult to trace, and Beer's market research left us some records of that history. At the same time, Beer's market research records show that in the early days of modern consumerism, Beer was beginning to feel its way through its customers' needs, however insufficient it appears to our eyes. Many surveys and studies were conducted covering national and regional as well as social, economic and psychological aspects of rail travel. And one of the major conclusions Beer had drawn from its market research was that passengers generally seem to be attracted by a certain factor of rail travel, that is speed. In 1968, Geoffrey Freeman Allen, the editor of Modern Railways, wrote in the Times that Beer should take seriously the high premium that the rail travel market placed on speed. In fact, Beer's own market research estimated that in a decade or so, a high-speed route between London and the North East could add from 200% to even 300% to the existing traffic. Hence, it seemed to justify the belief more speed can bring more rail passengers. The story of Beer's high-speed train, Intercity 125, is well known, is so well known that there is no need to repeat it here, and I will concentrate on the marketing aspect of its introduction. The development of the high-speed train officially started in 1968 in Beer, and it was eventually introduced for commercial service in 1976. As with most new service introduction, marketing figured prominently in the preparatory work for the new service. In the case of Intercity 125, it started around early 1975. In the marketing planning of the high-speed service, British Rail relied heavily on an advertising agency, Graham and Gillies. This agency had been working for the London Midland region of British Rail for 6 years, and in 1968 it was given the advertising work for the entire London area. The famous figure of Monica, for example, was possibly created by this advertising agency. It was Graham and Gillies that suggested the use of Intercity as the name of the high-speed train. From the report submitted to the British Rail by the agency, we can see that the use of the word high-speed train was intentionally avoided by the company. It was pointed out that some people had concerns about speed, so the agency recommended removing the word high-speed. For similar consideration, British Rail decided not to inform the passengers of the speed of the train in real time because, to quote, some passengers might become a little disturbed at the thought of hurtling along at 125 miles per hour, unquote. It was settled that the name of the train would be Intercity 125, where 125 refers to the maximum speed of the train. The agency was very much aware that the name was reminiscent of the ones used by airline companies, such as Boeing 747. However, these numerals in airplanes' names refer to the serial number of the airplane, whereas the numeral in Intercity 125 indicates speed. As the agency claimed, in this way, British Rail could retain the element of speed without being too explicit. Apart from the subtle manipulation of the image of speed, the fact that high speed gave way to Intercity, the main railway brand, shows that the marketing formed quite an important part of railway history in late 20th century Britain. The introduction of the Intercity 125 was enthusiastically received by Britain's travelling public. It added to the already successful Intercity network, whose passenger receipts increased from £78 million in 1968 to £290 million in 1977, while passenger miles increased from 6.6 million to 8.6 million. The belief in speed was characteristic of this period. In 1977, British Rail published a booklet entitled Quest for Speed. Intercity 125 was described in this booklet as British Rail's new thoroughbred, which flashes into the last quarter of the 20th century, while making the previous limits of speed dim memories. As we know, the quest for speed didn't solve all of Beer's problems, but as much as Intercity 125 contributed to Beer's passenger business, it certainly constituted a major part of the image of and the reality of railway travel in this period. By 1980, British Rail had been equipped with three strong elements of corporate identity, the saleable brand intercity, and the high-speed train. This gave Sir Peter Parker the confidence to say, to quote, "In a world where energy, labor relations, communications, and technology dominates, BR has been perforce in the forefront of our national life," unquote. This confidence tone was evident in BR's 1980 advertising campaign, and especially in the campaign's audacious title, "This is the Age of the Train." This campaign stands as strong evidence of the fairly optimistic mood of the rail passenger business in the early 1980s. In retrospect, some might wonder why the railways could be so hopeful about the future, as we know that BR would disappear a decade or so after this momentary burst of optimism. The contemporary statistics, however, show the clear upward trend in the performance of BR's passenger service. The passenger mileage in 1979 was the highest since 1961, when the rail network was 30% bigger. The public image was more difficult to generalize. From 1978, the market research company Mori conducted a series of annual surveys on BR's corporate image, which indicated that there were a growing number of satisfied intercity passengers, although other BR passenger services were eroding the overall image of British Rail. More encouraging was the 1982 survey by Kerr Gregory Research. In this survey, intercity was also accorded the pride of place. To quote, "Intercity has become synonymous with all that is good about the rail system. And for some, intercity has now become a synonym for rail travel. While intercity," the report continues, "stimulates a wide range of positive and exciting thoughts, the name British Rail tended to provoke negative feelings of industrial disputes as well as inefficient, uncomfortable, and dirty services. Nevertheless, when compared to British Railways, British Rail was doing much better in people's mind," according to the same report. A conceptual diagram in the report shows how negative attributes of the railways were relegated to the recent past of British Railways. Then the manipulation of history was possibly intentional. As Tim Strangleman suggested, the negative image of the nationalisation period was partly created in the late 1990s as part of the naturalisation process of the privatised railways in Britain. If that is the case, there seems to be plenty of justification for a thorough re-evaluation of the nationalisation period. Going back to the Kerr Gregory report, some further observations contained in the report must have pleased the BR officials, as the report stated that the train continued to be seen as the most exciting form of land-based transport. The feeling of excitement stemmed from going to distant places, the railway's mysterious technological world, and the power trains symbolized. And the praise of rail travel was contrasted with the familiar and ordinary experience of most forms of road travel. From this report, one might sense a sort of dramatic change in terms of the image attached to the train and the car. Since the interwar period, motoring had enticed people with its connotation of romance and freedom. In the 1980s, travel by car was gradually being burdened by the image of congestion, inconvenience and discomfort, at least to a certain extent. The changing image suggests an important transition in the relation between people and transport in Britain. At the same time, it indicates the complexity of the ways in which the notion and experience of travel have been constructed and understood. As early as 1963, BR recognized that the public image of the railways is based on the quality of service and the surroundings in which it is provided. With this belief, BR began to transform itself. This effort in turn was formulated based on BR's idea of what people wanted or would appreciate, an idea consolidated through its strenuous effort to know its customers. As a business, especially one experiencing fierce competition with other modes of transport, BR understood its design work as an effort to sell its service, an endeavor inseparable from marketing. The combination of design and marketing embraced by BR in this period culminated in its selling of The Age of the Train. BR marketing from the 1960s through to the early 1980s has impacted what people saw, heard, felt and experienced on and off the rail. In a world where there are diverse transport options, the railway's impact was relatively limited and nuanced. Even so, the story of BR marketing certainly gives us a deep understanding of the process by which the travel environment was co-constructed by transport providers and their real and potential customers. Thank you.
This talk was recorded on the 14th of September 2013 at the National Railway Museum, York. This podcast is copyright to the National Archives. All rights reserved.